Blog Talk Radio.
The 0-2 pitch, swing and a miss, struck him out. The Philadelphia Phillies are 2008 World Champions of Baseball.
The Eagles are headed to the Super Bowl.
Hey, it's Harry Jean and Merle Reese. What a way to start the show. It's Wednesday, May 21st, 2014. Welcome to Philly Press Box Radio Roundtable, brought to you by the shopforkisses.org, the online shopping network of the Kisses for Kyle's Foundation. I'm Bill Furman, and I'll be your host tonight, along with my partner, Jim Chetchesko. Welcome back, partner.
Great to be here as usual, Bill. Show number 4, and I'm pretty sure this is going to be another real entertaining one.
Yes, it is. I'm excited that we have another fantastic guest that's going to take us back to our childhood to talk Phillies baseball.
Yeah, that's for sure, Bill. We're going to talk primarily for the first half of the show about one of my favorite players as a young kid growing up in eastern Pennsylvania. I'll let you tell everyone who that is and who we have to discuss that legendary Phillies slugger. So take it away, Bill.
Okay. Well, Joe Ferry, along with Mark Carfagno, are heading up a drive to have Dick, Richie, when we were kids, Allen, inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. Joe will be joining us tonight on our Kiss for Kyle phone lines to tell us about the drive, how it got started, and why Dick Allen should be in the Hall of Fame, and what the listeners can do to help with the cause.
Yeah, I'm sure Joe's going to review Dick's numbers and give everyone some other evidence about Allen's great career to support that argument, plus reflect back on that Major League Baseball era, the 60s and 70s. Looking forward to this one.
Yeah, me too. I can't wait. We'll have our Shop for Kisses phone lines open at 929-477-2855, so feel free to call throughout the show. We do ask that all language be professional, all opinions are welcome, but please be respectful of other people's opinions. So with that said, let's get it going. Welcome, Joe Ferry, to the Philly Press Box Radio Roundtable.
Fellas, all right, Bill. Thanks very much. I appreciate this opportunity.
Bill
all
and
right,
Joe,
Jim,
we are thrilled to
away.
Have you here. Yep. In part, Joe, as I indicated, Richie Allen was probably my very first favorite Philly when I started watching the team around 1965 or 66. I guess the good news is that I was only 6 1/2 in the summer of 64, so I don't really have any memory of that unfortunate final 2 weeks of the 64 season, the infamous 64 season. Anyway, I know how old you are, Joe, and before we get to this campaign regarding Dick Allen, just tell me about growing up in Southwest Philly and how you came to love listening to and watching Major League Baseball.
Well, the Phillies were the center of our summer universe during those years. Those hot summer nights spent on front porches with our transistor radios, listening to the games, Harry Whitey and Bill Campbell calling the calling those long home runs by Dick Allen. It's just something that just makes you feel good when you think about those days of our youth.
Yeah, and of course, Richie Allen, Rookie of the Year in 1964. What are your memories of the first couple of years of Richie Allen's career as a Philly?
Well, I think anybody who followed his career back then would just think of those monstrous home runs that he used to hit over the left field wall at Connie Mack Stadium. And we do remember the left field wall, but some of his more memorable home runs were hit over that right center field wall, which was 447 feet from home plate over that Ballantyne beer scoreboard. And that they're the ones that people are just amazed at, because a right-handed hitter with that kind of power was unheard of.
Didn't I read somewhere that he hit like 18 home runs completely out of Connie Mack Stadium, like over the 75-foot-high grandstand?
Exactly. He was legendary for the 42-ounce bat that he swung and the long, long home runs that, in some cases, legend or not, we're told were still on the rise when they hit a light standard or when they hit a sign. So some of the stories are just amazing about the power that he had as a hitter.
I mentioned the 64 collapse. What are your memories of that, Joe?
Well, I was about 10 years old, and I just remember all the adults around me just being completely crushed by what was going on. I didn't really have a sense of how important it was or how devastating it was going to be to them losing that 6.5-game lead with 12 to play. But I could tell by the way the adults were acting around me that they were not happy.
Yeah. Now, Bill, of course, was already a Phillies fan by that time. So, Bill, jump in here. I'm sure you have a lot of questions for Joe as well.
Yeah, I guess, Joe, the thing that I remember the most as a kid, and I was really young as well, but he's the only guy I can remember my father stopping whatever he was doing to watch him at bat, watch his at bat.
That's another thing that we have found quite a bit of stories from the past, that when Dick Allen came to bat, the concession stands were pretty quiet because everybody wanted to see what he'd do next.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I remember the things I remember as an early on, you know, obviously an extremely talented guy, had trouble fitting in a little bit, not very good on defense that first year. I want to say 41 errors, if I recall, over at third base. But gosh, what talent, and everybody could tell it.
Exactly, and unfortunately the Phillies did him no favor by signing him when they did to what was then an amazingly high $70,000 bonus, and then sending him to Little Rock, Arkansas, where he made his professional debut. And let's just say he did not receive a warm reception from the locals. And that's the kind of thing that I think followed him through his career. He was misunderstood, he was misinterpreted, and I think a lot of it started from the reception that he got in Little Rock back in 1960.
Yeah, there was a lot of racism, I guess, at that time, so he heard a lot of taunts from the crowd. I think people would throw things at him. Was that tough for him to handle, and how did he handle those kind of fans?
Absolutely. I mean, the first year in 1964 was fine. Things started to go sour when he had the incident with Frank Thomas, and the Phillies ended up releasing Frank Thomas. Dick was blamed for what happened there, and unfortunately he was never allowed to tell his side of the story, which in fact was that Frank Thomas was baiting him and some other players with some racial taunts, and Dick had enough of it, and got into a fisticuffs and ended up having Frank Thomas released. And after that, Dick Allen just could not do anything right as far as Philadelphia fans were concerned. It was quite a shame that all that talent was being ignored and the racial aspect was being emphasized too much.
Yeah, and in addition to the racial taunts, apparently Thomas went after Allen with a bat, according to some witnesses. So that was really a lot of things to deal with for a young guy in his, second year in baseball at that time.
It was really tough. And that was, if you remember, that was a difficult racial time in Philadelphia as well. So I have a feeling a lot of people took their emotions out on him because he was a very public figure. The city was going through some difficult times in the mid-60s, and unfortunately Dick Allen became a target for some of the racial animosity that was going on.
But I want to ask you to throw a couple stats at you, Joe, and then I want to get on to asking you how you got involved in this and what you guys are trying to do to get it accomplished. But let's start with some stats. 351 career home runs, 1,119 RBIs, .292 career batting average, played for 15 years. 1964 Rookie of the Year, 1972 American League MVP, 7-time All-Star, 2-time home run champ, 1-time RBI champ, 3 times 100-plus RBIs, and 7 times over 300 batting average. I mean, the numbers are pretty staggering. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, the numbers are strong on their own, but remember that was a severely depressed offensive era. It was towards the end of the 1960s that baseball decided to lower the mound and increase the strike zone and make it easier for hitters. And Dick was really at his best during the offensive era that was not as productive as some of the more modern eras. And one other stat that you might want to mention or I think is important in his career is a 912 OPS. Of course, that's a combination of on-base percentage and slugging percentage. And during the time of Dick Allen's career, this is one of the stats that we think is pretty strong, between 1963 and 1977, of course, his OPS was 912. The only player with a higher OPS during that particular time was Henry Aaron with a 917 OPS.
So, yeah, and keep in mind, he was batting against some pitchers like Bob Gibson, Don Drysdale, Sandy Koufax, Juan Marichal, some pretty good arms back
sure.
in the 60s.
Before the pre-expansion era that started in 1969 when the Expos and the Padres came in, sure, he was playing at a time when there were only eight teams in the National League, I think, at that point, 8 or 10 teams. The talent was not nearly as diluted as it is now.
Well, let me ask you, with that said, with playing in the same era with Mays and Aaron and Clemente and some of those guys, do you feel like that hurt him, or, you know, the statistics match up pretty well with those guys?
Really what we feel is that Dick has been ignored for the Hall of Fame to this point because of an undeserved reputation as not being a model teammate. And that's one of the obstacles we're going to have in this campaign is convincing the people that make the decisions that Dick was, in fact, a great teammate and well-liked by his teammates, his managers, and people in the front office.
Yeah, now there were some negatives, though, that you've got to overcome. I mean, he had trouble with punctuality. He was often late for meetings, and I think he missed a doubleheader once. He was said to enjoy, you know, boozing and gambling. Of course, he had that infamous fight with Frank Thomas, and he put his right hand through a car headlight in 1967. So there are some things working against him, clearly.
They are, and we think a lot of them undeserved and not particularly germane to being evaluated as a Hall of Famer. We think some of the stories are just not accurate, and we just think that they shouldn't preclude him from being a Hall of Famer.
Yeah, it didn't stop Ty Cobb from getting in.
No, there's plenty of players with less than stellar reputations in there. But we really think, Dick, if people will take the time, and again, part of our campaign is getting the testimonials from players, his contemporaries that he played with and played against, who have nothing but good things to say about him as a teammate. This is one of the stories we came across. Red Shaneyeast was a coach with the Cardinals, and when the Cardinals were thinking about trading for him from the Phillies, he didn't want to do it. He had a negative feeling about how Dick would fit in with their clubhouse. And then when they decided they might have to trade him after one season, Red Shaneyeast was against it because he had a chance to see Dick up close and personal, knew him as a leader, knew him as a player who was committed to winning and didn't want to get rid of him. So we have testimonials and stories like that. Seems like an endless list of them. Goose Gossage, Hall of Famer, said Dick Allen was the best teammate he ever played with, and in fact credits Dick Allen with teaching him how to pitch, that they talked about hitting so much that Goose Gossage learned how to pitch from Dick Allen.
Yeah, even Mike Schmidt in the mid-70s when they were teammates, Mike Schmidt had a lot of good things to say about Dick Allen. He said, you know, he's got nothing bad really to say. He said that Dick Allen told him that he had to relax and have some fun and, you know, go up there and bat like when you were a little kid and all that
exactly.
kind of stuff. So Schmitty speaks very highly of Dick Allen.
I mean, when Dick came back to Philadelphia, the two people who led the charge to get him back in town were Mike Schmidt and Richie Ashburn. They both felt that he was the kind of player that the Phillies needed to get over the top. If you remember the 74, 75, 76, 77 era when they were just starting to be good and being a contender, they felt that Dick Allen was the kind of player that they needed to put him over the top.
Well, let me put you on the spot. If he was a good teammate, as you say he was, why did Dick Allen spend just 1 year in both St. Louis and L.A. in 70 and 71?
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't know what dynamics were going on with their team, whether they needed something that he could provide in ways of trade. But I know the White Sox were happy to get him in 1972 when they did get him.
Yeah, and how about that year he had with the White Sox in 72 when he won the MVP? That was, you know, a great season for a slugger like Allen, wasn't it?
One of the more amazing seasons of any player. And, in fact, Dick is credited by some people with saving the White Sox franchise. In fact, their attendance in 1971 had been about 400,000, and there was a lot of talk about them moving out of Chicago. And when he came to Chicago in 72, seemed to reinvigorate that franchise. They drew 1.3 million, and of course, they're still in Chicago. So a lot of people credit him with saving that franchise with his dynamic play in that 72 season.
Do you think that the fact that he, in his 15-year career, that he only played in one postseason, and that was with the 76 Phillies, that hurts him in any way?
I don't think so. I think in baseball it's such a sport that one player cannot be held responsible for a team's success or failure when it comes to the postseason. I just don't think that would be appropriate, as you could in basketball or maybe even football. A player can lead you to the playoffs or into the championship. I think baseball, there's just way too many variables that one person can't do it on their own. So I don't think that should be held against them at all.
Hey, in his years that he's been eligible for the Hall of Fame, has he come close at all?
He has not. He has not. And in fact,
yeah, I was actually going to toss that out there for you, because to me this is probably your biggest hurdle, as and we'll get a little more into this. But from 1983 to 1997, he was on the ballot. 97 was his last one, and he only got between 3.7% and his high of 18.9%. That's
wow.
You've got your hands full.
And one of the way that we're campaign or the campaign that we're putting together for him now is under the Golden Era Committee, and this is for players who primarily played the bulk of their career between 1947 and 1973. And this Golden Era Committee was put together, in fact, to give the players who were overlooked a second chance, a second look. They're supposed to be judged against their peers in this Golden Era Committee. So not players who played before them, not players who came after them, the players that they played against. And that's where we think Dick Allen shines, because one of the stats that we're hanging our hat on is OPS Plus. OPS Plus is a more refined version of OPS. It does adjust for things like park effects, but it gives a good comparison between players who played in the same era, played against the same pitchers, played in the same stadiums. And what we've uncovered is that between 64 and 73, there were 17 Hall of Famers who played 1,000 or more games during those 10 seasons. Dick Allen's OPS of 165 was higher than all of them, including Henry Aaron, Willie McCovey, Frank Robinson, Harmon Killebrew, Willie Stargell, Roberto Clemente, Willie Mays, Carl Yastrzemski, Al Kaline, Billy Williams, and the most recent inductee in the Golden Era Committee, Ron Santo.
Wow. And so
we think he stands up clearly with his peers. In an offensively depressed era, he was as good as anybody.
Aren't his RBI totals right up there in the top three or four of that group you just mentioned as well?
Yep. 1,119, I think, was the exact number. So, he's right there with that. And here's another thing that we've looked up. I don't know if you're familiar with the black ink test. This is a measure that Bill James came up with to measure a player's worthiness for the Hall of Fame based on how many times they've led the league in a particular offensive category. So there's a black ink test, and that's the most stringent one. That's the toughest one. Dick Allen is ranked 70th all-time with a score of 27. So he's 70th all-time in this ranking of Hall of Fame worthiness. And that's better than 33 current Hall of Famers, including Bernie Banks, Lou Brock, Clemente, Johnny Bench, Billy Williams, Willie Stargell. So he's 70th all-time in that measure. Then there's a gray ink test.
Speaking of Bill James, is Bill James not been attributed a bit to Dick not getting in the Hall of Fame back in the day?
Yes. And he made a statement not too long ago that Dick Allen did more to keep his teams from winning than any other player in the history of baseball. And he said, if that's a Hall of Famer, I'm a lug nut. Well, I'm here to tell you that Bill James is a lug nut, because he doesn't know what he's talking about when it comes to Dick Allen's performance as a player. And in fact, it's many of Bill James's statistical measures that we're using to prove his worthiness for the Hall of Fame. I think what Bill's hanging his hat on is the reputation, undeserved, we say, of Dick as a bad teammate. It's just not true.
Did he ever expand on that about what was his thought process?
No. He's given Dick plenty of credit as a outstanding offensive player. but he made that vague statement about doing more to hurt teams, his team's chances of winning than any other player in the history of baseball, other than perhaps Ty Cobb, I think he said, because Ty Cobb was such a malcontent. But he can't there's no way to quantify that. There's no way to quantify whether he did more to hurt his team. Look at the numbers. Look at what he put up in the time, the 10 years that he was the best player, best offensive player in the game.
Well, Joe, I think this would be a good time to tell us more about the campaign. I guess it's you and Mark and the help of Dick Allen's son, Richard Jr.
Yes, actually, this started with Richard Allen Jr. hoping to get recognition for his father. He was aware of some of the negative things. He was too young, really, to remember how Dick was treated during his time in Philadelphia, but he is aware that it was that way, and he'd like to set the record straight by getting by having him elected to the Hall of Fame. Dick himself has not stepped forward to be any part of the campaign. He doesn't want to be seen as someone who's campaigning for himself to get into the Hall of Fame, and I completely respect that. But between Richard Allen Jr., my buddy Frog, and myself, we're trying to make the case that he has been unfairly overlooked and is a worthy Hall of Fame member.
Are you finding lots of support out there?
We are. There's a Hall of Fame. Dick Allen Belongs in the Hall of Fame Facebook page that has gotten quite a few comments. Just recently, in the last two or three weeks, this blows my mind. Philadelphia City Council, led by Councilman Jim Kenney, passed a resolution in support of Dick Allen being elected to the Hall of Fame. And to think that 40 some years later, the city that essentially rejected him has embraced him as a Hall of Famer, I think is just an amazing transformation. And I think it's people looking back through the lens of time and eliminating the emotions from it, seeing Dick for the kind of player that he was.
So is there anything special people can do, people who want to help out this cause?
Go to that Dick Allen Belongs in the Hall of Fame Facebook page. Leave your comments there. It is a bit of a mystery who we have to make our case to as far as getting him on the Golden Era ballot, which happens around the World Series, and then having him elected to the Hall of Fame. The Golden Era ballot, there's only 10 players eligible each year for the Golden Era ballot. And since Ron Santo was elected last time, there's one open spot this time, and we're hoping that Dick Allen will get on the ballot this time. So we have to make our case to the screening committee that decides who goes on the ballot, and then once he's on the ballot, make our case to the Hall of Fame election committee that will decide who goes in.
Well, how did you and Frog get involved in this? What is there a relationship there, or how did this all come about for you guys?
Yeah, Frog and I go back to the mid-60s when we were students at Most Blessed Sacrament and then West Catholic High School. He fortunately got a job with the Phillies on the ground crew and spent 33 years with them, and we've obviously kept in touch over the years. And after his time with the Phillies came to an end, he wanted to write a book. And my background is as a journalist and as a writer, so we sat down and looked through 20,000 words that he had sketched out over the couple of years, and actually made a nice book out of it all that touches on his time growing up in Southwest Philly, his time with the Mummers, and his time mostly the 33 years that he spent as a member of the grounds crew with the Phillies. And there's some really interesting and fun stories in that book.
Well, give yourself a plug. What's the name of the book?
Hardball and Hardships, Mark, My Time with the Phillies, Member of the Ground Crew by Mark Carfagno. I think it might still be available through his website, which is frogcarfagno.com.
Nice.
Gotcha.
Ready to play a little rapid fire, Joe?
Yeah, that sounds like fun. Anytime, sure.
Okay, here's the deal. Over the next 2 minutes or so, I'm going to hit you with 10, 11, or 12 questions. Try to keep your answers as brief as possible, maybe one sentence, two at the most. Whatever comes to mind. You ready?
Gotcha. Anytime.
All right, here we go. Joe, what is one thing about Dick Allen people might not know or might have forgotten?
he was an outstanding basketball player. Butch Van Predikoff said he was the best basketball player he ever saw.
Is it true also that Dick Allen was a pretty decent singer?
He was. He recorded a song in 1964. I can't remember the name of it now, but he Echoes of Summer, I think it was called. But yeah,
Echoes of November.
Echoes of November. Okay.
He even had a group, Rich Allen and the Ebonistics.
They obviously didn't go too far in their music career.
It's actually available on YouTube. Check it out, Rich Allen singing. All right, did you ever read Dick's 1989 book, Crash, and how'd you like it?
I have read excerpts from it. I've done my research, but I haven't read the whole book. Tim Whitaker is the author there, and we've reached out to him to see if he wants to help us in this campaign.
Yes, I read it, and it was actually pretty entertaining.
All right,
as we mentioned, Dick Allen wasn't a great third baseman. Why wasn't he moved to first base sooner?
Let's see. Good question. Who was the first baseman for the Phillies at the time? Johnny Hernstein, Johnny Briggs. They probably
I can't remember. Frank Thomas.
He was better suited to third base than first base at that particular time.
You're obviously a Dick Allen fan. Name three other players from that era that you loved to watch play. They could be Phillies or opponents.
I'll be honest. Johnny Callison was my favorite player only because I was a left-handed hitter and a right fielder. So if you ask me my personal favorite player, Johnny Callison was it. Chris Short, because I became a left-handed pitcher, he was a favorite. And then, of course, Jim Bunning with his performance on Father's Day of 1964. Anytime I got to watch him play that was awesome.
Yeah, I was a Callison fan, too. And, of course, Tony Taylor.
Tony Taylor.
Besides Dick Allen and maybe Pete Rose, what other guys come to mind who should be in the Hall of Fame but aren't?
On the Phillies.
Yeah, anywhere.
Yeah. I believe it or not, I think Louis Tian has a shot. I think if you look at his numbers, he certainly belongs. And I do think Tony Oliva is another player that deserves to be in. His numbers are strong, especially during that.
Great hitter. Great hitter, Tony Oliva.
Yeah, absolutely.
A couple I came up with were Tim Raines and Al Oliver also.
Okay. Yeah, I'd go for either one of them.
Should steroid-era players like Bonds, Sosa, and McGuire ever be admitted?
That's a tough one. I can't quantify how steroids may have helped them, so yes, I think they should be allowed in.
All right. I know you still watch the Phillies currently, so on a percentage basis, what are the chances Jimmy Rollins will make the Hall of Fame?
I think they're pretty good. You have to look at his complete body of work, and at a time when offense and defense are at a premium, I think Jimmy has been one of the best shortstop of his era, and I think that's one of the criteria being a Hall of Famer.
And finally, what kind of contract would Dick Allen be able to sign in today's game?
He probably would only get about $1 million a year because you got to remember he is 72 years old.
That's right.
That's an old line from Babe Ruth. How many home runs do you think you'd hit today? And he said, probably 20. Well, what's the matter? He said, I'm 85.
Yeah, if he were 25, he'd probably be getting one of those $20 million contracts for sure.
I think he'd be the Albert Pujols of his era.
Yes, indeed. Thanks for playing along, Joe.
Oh, thank you. That was fun.
I do have to tell a story, though, regarding Dick Allen. As I was getting ready to do the show, and I was telling my wife, who knows nothing about baseball, that we were going to have you on, Joe, and we were going to talk about Dick Allen being, should he be in the Hall of Fame? And she looked at me real funny, and I said, what's the matter? She said, Dick Allen, is that Richie Allen? And I said, yeah. She says, isn't he the one that you got the first autograph from that started this crazy memorabilia collection that you've put together? And sure enough, in 1985, Richie Allen was at a show. I went and I got the picture that I posted on Facebook to show this event, the 1964 Phillies portrait picture, and I got it signed at the show for $4, and also got two baseballs signed for $4 each at the time, and that started this collection that has become, in her mind, more of an addiction nearly 30 years later. So I did get the chance to meet Dick Allen, and he's on the top of my list, or first on my list anyway.
So he's the one that sparked your addiction for memorabilia, huh?
Yes, it did. Yes, he did.
There you go. See, all good things.
All right, Joe.
Well, is there anything else that you want to toss out as we move on? And you're more than welcome to stay with us if you'd like, and we're going to talk a little bit of Phillies and 76ers. You're welcome to stay.
I just think send your good vibes our way, and good luck for Dick Allen, and hopefully we'll see him in Cooperstown in 2015.
That'll be great.
Okay,
thanks, Joe.
And the listeners can look up Dick Allen should be in the Hall of Fame on Facebook. Isn't that right?
Exactly. Yep.
Okay. Well, Joe, thanks for being with us.
Thanks.
We wish you
much.
Well in your venture, and of course, Dick Allen being voted into the Hall of Fame. We sure appreciate your time. Enjoyed the heck out of it, and good stuff.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it, guys.
Okay. All right. Hey, Chet, guess what? I found another way of saving money by getting cash back on my purchases at the same time. Each of the purchases benefits the Kisses for Kyle Foundation.
I love saving money myself, so what do we have to do, Bill?
Okay, well, we went to the website, www.shopforkisses.org, logged in because they're already registered as a preferred customer free of charge, went to the Home Depot on the All Stores tab and bought myself a $200 gift card to use to purchase things on my home repair list. I received 3% cash back, or $6, to be used later. 6 minutes later, my gift card was on the computer. I printed it, and off to the store I went with my list. Basically, I got $200 for the cost of $194, and KFK benefited as well. It's that simple. It's another great way to get a little money back and help families dealing with childhood cancer through the Kisses for Kyle Foundation. If you have any questions or you'd like to sign up yourself, just do what I did and go to the register button and make it happen. If you have any questions, contact Bob Sullivan at bobsullivan.shopcom@gmail.com or give him a call at 484-319-8043. We'll post this contact information on our Facebook page, Philly Press Box Radio, as well. Be sure to tell him you heard about them from Philly Press Box Radio. Okay, partner, let's move on and we haven't spent a whole lot of time on our shows talking about the 76ers. Well, last night was lottery night, and, yeah, there's been a good reason. So we've got the number 3 lottery pick and the number 10 pick. What do you think?
Yeah, there hasn't been much to talk about the 76ers since the trade deadline, I guess, back in February. But, yeah, now we can talk about them. Ideally, Bill, they would have gotten the 2nd and 10th picks, or, of course, the 1st and 10th picks. But instead, it's 3rd and 10th, which isn't a terrible thing this year. It is a pretty deep draft. And by the way, if you watched the lottery show last night, how about Dr. J's look of surprise and dismay when it was announced that the Sixers got that 10th pick? He admitted later that he wasn't aware that they had the New Orleans pick coming to them. So he thought, well, that's it. That's it, 10th pick. But, yeah. They straightened about. Pat Williams nudged him and said, no, you get another pick, don't worry. Anyway, yeah, number 3 and number 10, so certainly a lot of opportunity to get two high-quality players in this deep draft, and, of course, it gives all of us something to talk about over the next 5 weeks. Number 3 and number 10, what's your view, Bill?
Well, I think, you know, the number 3 pick, I think it's one of the three guys, right? I mean, it's going to be Embiid, Wiggins, or Parker. I think they're going to go 1, 2, 3 in some order, don't you think?
That's what everybody says. I mean, Wiggins is the consensus number one, although there was a story out today that Cleveland, which got the number 1 pick again somehow, might be interested in Joel Embiid. So we shall see. And if that happened, then Wiggins would probably go 2nd. Either way, you would think that would put Parker in the number 3 slot, and the Sixers would certainly consider taking him. Parker, a 6'8", small forward, 235 pounds. So he just played 1 year at Duke. Of course, you know, everybody seems to play 1 or 2 years anymore and leave. So he's still probably a little green for the NBA, but at the same time, he might be more ready to play even than Wiggins at this point. So, I mean, you can't argue with a pick of Jabari Parker if that's what the Sixers decided to do at number 3.
Yeah, I think the thing about these three guys is I'm not sure any of the three are really game changers this second. I think they're all a bit works in progress. There's no Jordan, there's no LeBron, there's no Kobe, you know, and Durant in this draft. But guys that might be solid pieces to build around. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame that guys leave after 1 year of college like this, because most of them aren't ready. I mean, there's going to be the exceptions, like the Kobe Bryant, who didn't even need college. Some guys can come out and be ready after 1 year of college, but normally there's going to be some seasoning required. So I don't think anybody anymore is going to step right in and, you know, be amazing. Yeah, Michael Carter-Williams had a very nice year. He was Rookie of the Year for the Sixers, but it's still not like, you know, a surefire thing like a Michael Jordan or even in retrospect with the way Kobe ended up playing right away. So it's still a crapshoot to an extent. Everybody seems to like those three, but then there's also other guys to consider. You know, do you want to move up Julius Randle to the third spot if you're the Sixers? He's a 6'9 power forward. Maybe he'd be a better fit than Parker. So Sam Hinkie and company do have a lot of decisions to make. I mean, the other thing they could do, of course, is make some sort of a trade and, you know, drop down a little bit or maybe move up to number two or one if they decide they really, really have to have Wiggins or Embiid. I don't think it would be Embiid, but maybe Wiggins. So I'm sure Sam Hinkie's going to be taking a lot of phone calls over the next few weeks. Maybe he'll even be making a few of his own. Who knows?
It'd be interesting after the season that they had and all the maneuvering they did and all the draft picks that they had, if they did trade down, boy, what in the world would you trade down for? Next year or the one the following year? I mean, I don't know what you can get in a two-round draft to begin with.
And they've already got, what, 5 second-round picks? So, boy, that's a lot of picks. Hey, one guy I want to throw out there is Shabazz Napier of UConn. I mean, he had that great March Madness 4-week period or whatever, really a star leading UConn to the title. And I'm seeing him anywhere from, like, 12 or 13 overall in the draft to mid-second round. So, I mean, he's a guy who's just really intriguing to a lot of people, but maybe less so to some other people. Maybe it's because he's only 6'1". I don't know. But, I mean, the guy played, what, the full 4 years at UConn. He's seasoned. He showed what he can do in leading the Huskies to the title. I'm surprised that some people aren't higher on him after the tournament that he had.
Well, don't you kind of think that, you know, overall his career was fairly average until the tournament when he was just lights out?
Yeah, and that's probably what's working against him, that and the fact that, you know, maybe he's only 6'1", and some people would like a little more height from the point guard position, so I don't know. But it's going to be interesting to see where he goes. I don't think he's going to fall to the second round, I'll tell you that. Some people do, but I don't think he'll fall that much.
Well, what do you think about McDermott? Would you like to see McDermott at that 10 spot, or do you think that he's
would,
gone before
that's,
then?
That's where a lot of people have him, right, in that 8, 9, 10, 11 area, so yeah, I would love to see him. I mean, he's a guy who is more seasoned. He played 4 years at Creighton. The guy can score. He's 6'8", so, you know, he can be a power forward. He's not a huge guy. He's more of a shooter than a, you know, inside guy. But I would love seeing Doug McDermott in the Sixers uniform. He can shoot. He can score. And I think he'd be fun to watch.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I'd like to see him get a guy that can just shoot the lights out. And at least at the college level, McDermott could sure do that.
There's that guy out of Australia, too, that a lot of people are high on, Dante Exum. There's not a whole lot of videotape on him, but apparently the guy can shoot pretty well. He's a shooting guard. He's 6'5", but I don't know. That would be a gamble. I wouldn't take him. I would go with, you know, something of more of a sure thing, if that's possible anymore.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I think, you know, obviously, as you said, they've got to make a ton of moves. They've got a new roster that really didn't play much together. They've got to decide who they're keeping, who they're drafting, and they have a ton of cap space. And with that said, do you see them venturing into the free agent market for some superstar type players? And
yeah,
if
I don't
so,
know
do you
available.
Think we can get them here?
I think we can, because I think some guys are going to see it as a good opportunity. I think even though he's been there only a year and the team only won 19 games, I think Brett Brown's got a pretty good reputation. You know, he was tutored in San Antonio for all those years, of course, under Popovich. He's a smart guy, and I think he knows how to coach, and I think a lot of guys would love to play for him. Plus, you got Michael Carter-Williams at point guard. He's a guy who's going to get you the ball. Other than that, you got a rookie center who sat out this past year, Nerlens Noel, who a lot of people are pretty high on. Some people not so high. They think, yeah, maybe he's just more of a defensive guy, but I think he's going to be good in the middle. He may be like a Dikembe Mutombo thing, which isn't all bad. A nice defensive presence in the middle. So you got him at center. You got Thaddeus Young at one of the forwards, and you got Michael Carter-Williams. That's three good building blocks right there. You're probably going to have Tony Roten coming off the bench. I think he did a nice job for the Sixers this year. Beyond that, I don't know who's going to be back from this past year. So you're going to have a lot of guys competing for jobs, and I think some of the free agents who are out there, maybe not the top of the line big name free agents, but some of the, you know, second tier free agents, whoever they may be, would definitely see this as an opportunity to advance this their career and to help the 76ers, you know, make the playoffs, maybe not this year but the following year, and then become a contender within 2 or 3 years. And I think they can be if they make the right moves.
Well, that's interesting, and I guess one of the things that I wonder, you know, as the NBA has settled itself out over the last, say, 20 years, you know, when you have the Allen Iverson kind of guys that came in and it was a one-man band, and he did it all, and everybody else was a supporting cast, and now you see the James Wade Bosch deal, and, you know, and you have Durant and his buddies, and you know, you no longer have that, where you've got more team-type guys, but they're multiple superstars on the team. And I guess that's a real question for me. Can we, you know, do we build through the draft and take whatever, 2, 3, 5 years to do that? Or do we go out and, like you say, maybe get a handful of guys that are second-tier stars and put together a real team that can make a run?
Sam Hinkie's going to be a busy guy over the next couple of months, I'll tell you that. I'm really curious to see what they're going to do, and there's going to be a lot of anticipation come draft night, which is, what, June 26th, I believe, to see just what the Sixers do at number 3 and number 10 and then all those second-round picks. And you don't know, you could get a gem in the second round. They say it is a deep draft, and, I mean, let's face it, sometimes you do find, you know, somebody a little further down, like a John Stockton or whoever, who, you know, comes out of nowhere and surprises you and becomes a superstar in the league for 10 or 12 years.
Right. Well, I mean, we'll see, and I hope I really hope that the Sixers get this thing turned around. The basketball in Philadelphia has been a fantastic sport for our whole lives, and I'd sure like to see it get back and see them compete and make a playoff run and be a formidable sport in Philadelphia.
Yeah, me too. I love basketball, and the Sixers were actually fun to watch the first part of this season. And then when they got rid of, you know, Hawes and Turner and obviously were tanking, they weren't so much fun to watch anymore. So I want to get back to having a good time watching my 76ers basketball team.
I'm with you. I'm with you 100%. Well, let's talk about the Phillies for a little bit. They had a breakout weekend. They pounded the baseball against the Reds. They won again last night in Miami. You think they hang in there? I mean, they're just so inconsistent. One night they don't hit. One night the starters are average. One night the bullpen breaks down. But what do you see?
Boy, you hit the nail on the head, Bill. I got to be honest. 7 weeks into the season, I still don't know what to make of this Phillies team. I was totally ready to write them off last Friday night after they'd lost their 7th game out of 9, another shutout. They just looked like they didn't care. Then, wham, they win 3 games in a row, and not only win 3 in a row, but it was 3 games in which they averaged something like 8.7 runs a game. Which team is the real Phillies? I'm pretty sure even Ruben Amaro and Ryan Sandberg aren't quite sure yet, so we have to keep an eye on that. And, of course, then we got the Cliff Lee news late last night, early this morning, that he's on the DL for at least 15 days with an elbow flexor thingy. So he's going to be down for at least 2 weeks, and I wouldn't be surprised if it's more like a month, because that's not something they're going to rush him back from. So a lot of things to watch with the Phillies in the weeks ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. And, boy, when you are playing halfway decent ball and you lose a guy like Lee, that's tough. And, you know, they've lost Pettibone, apparently. He's not an option to come back up as he's injured. So I'm not sure what they're going to do as a number 5 starter.
Yeah, now for today, they called up Darren Ruff because they put Cliff Lee on the disabled list, but they will make another move probably on Saturday when Lee was scheduled to pitch next, I believe. I heard some rumors that it might be David Buchanan, who had that good spring for the Phils down in Clearwater. I'm not sure how he's doing at Lehigh Valley, but he would certainly be an option. So we'll see, because, I mean, they don't have any days off right now. They got 20 games in 20 days and something like, I don't know, 49 games out of the next 50 days or something. So they are going to need a starter every fifth day when Cliff Lee is not there. So going to be interesting to see what they do.
Absolutely. And, you know, I know you know this because we talked about it a little bit last night, but I just cannot understand this whole bullpen thing and the A.J. Burnett being lifted after five innings and throwing only in the 90s again, 90-some pitches. You know, they're killing Jake Diekman. They're just there's no way the kid makes it through the season. He's on an 80-plus game pace, and now they're throwing for two innings.
Yeah, I mean, and the good news is he looked good. He's actually pitched very well over the last week and a half or so. Two scoreless innings last night, as you said. But, yeah, you can't go out there and do that every night, have him go almost every night and two innings some nights. That bullpen is going to be really worn out before July 1st. We talked about this last week. You got to get the starters going deeper. Burnett wasn't overly sharp last night. Maybe that's part of the reason he only went five innings. Cliff Lee wasn't overly sharp in his last start on Saturday, I guess. That's a real struggle. You want to keep those guys in there for seven or eight innings, but when it looks like they're having trouble with their command, you know, I could see why they do get them out of there some nights. Of course, last night, I don't know how much you saw of the game, nobody was real happy with the home plate umpire. He was just squeezing pitchers on both sides, so that was another reason there were so many walks.
Yeah, and you know, each pitcher threw, or each team threw 175 pitches in that game last night.
Yeah. And, hey, speaking of the strikes, and we'll get back to the Phillies in a minute, I was watching the Phils on Sunday, and T-Mac and Schmitty, I guess it was, maybe Jamie Moyer also, they were talking about the strike zone. You know, the rule book clearly says what the strike zone is. What is it, the letters down at the top of the knees or whatever? Why do umpires refuse to call the high strike? Tell me that, Bill.
Well, you know, I heard that conversation too, and I thought it was outstanding. I actually commented to some people about, you know, Schmidt and Matt Stairs having that conversation, and even Mike Schmidt said the strike zone is so much smaller now than when he played.
Yeah,
he said there's no black. You know, there's nothing on the corners. And nothing above the waist.
Yeah, anything above the belt is a ball. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, and I mean, and now he tried to clarify that, you know, by saying about the angles of the cameras and maybe you're not seeing exactly right. But, you know, yeah. One of the comments that they made I thought was interesting was because they have an extra umpire crew now, there's a whole bunch of extra umpires this year because of the way they're doing the replays, that there are a whole lot of younger umpires, I shouldn't call them kids, I guess, younger umpires in baseball, which they're feeling like that's leading to a lot of the inconsistency.
Hmm. Could be.
I'd rather see consistency
more than anything.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you can't throw 350 pitches in a baseball game, for God's sake. That's, you know, the game was 3.5 hours. It went nine innings, but 350 pitches. You talk about, you know, losing fans' interest. That'll do it. Some of it's the hitters are roaming around the batter's box, and, you know, and pitchers are a little slow at times. Commercial breaks are long. There's a whole lot of things going on, but at the end of the day, 350 pitches is too many pitches in a game.
Yeah, it is. Now, getting back to the Phillies, they, as we mentioned, they had the breakout weekend Saturday and Sunday beating the Reds. They held on for a 6-5 win last night. One of the bright spots Saturday was Dom Brown. He knocked in five runs, I guess, in his second home run of the season, finally, but really hasn't done all that much since. His average is only .216, and I'm thinking he's a key for the Phils. If they're going to make any kind of a run this year in that poor NL East division, I think Dom Brown's got to get hot, and he just hasn't really done that at all yet this year.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, And you could see what happened to the team when he did hit the ball a little bit over the weekend, and Cody Ashe as well, you know, was swinging a nice bat, and all of a sudden they're starting to score a whole bunch of runs. They're adding, you know, they're adding some pop in the bottom of the lineup that they just haven't had any of. And but with that, I want to say, you know, with Ruff coming up, it's going to be interesting to see where he plays. Where's this guy fit?
Yeah, they're going to get him in left field once in a while. They're going to put him at first base once in a while, give Howard a rest here and there. We shall see. I'd like to see what he can do if he gets to play a little bit. And you mentioned Cody Ashe. I'm glad you did, because it was last Wednesday that we had our last Philly Press Box Radio Roundtable show, and it was the night after Ashe made those three errors. And, you know, what has he done since? Well, he's gone on a bit of an offensive tear. He's played a good third base. He's got his average up to 252. He was down in the 220s. So that was really great to see a young guy recovering from that, you know, horrible three-error game, really bouncing back. And I was really happy to see that, because I like Cody Ashe. I think he can be a player.
Yeah, and you know I like him too, and I've talked a lot about him. I think he's going to be good. And, you know, watching that game with the errors, you could see he either wanted to dig a hole and crawl in it, or he wanted to cry.
Yeah.
You know, and you couldn't blame him. He just, things just weren't going his way that day. And I also thought it was interesting in Sunday's broadcast where, you know, Mike Schmidt reached out to him and said,
right,
you know, hey, that we've all been there. It happens. And Matt Stairs said the same thing. It happens. You know, forget about it. Move on. And you're a good player. You wouldn't be here. And boom, the guy gets warm, and he's hitting the baseball all over the field now.
Happened to me as a high school senior playing shortstop back at Mahanoy area back in the day. Three errors in not only one game, in one inning. And I just wanted to dig a hole and crawl in. But I think they ended up moving me to second base for the rest of the year. So I survived.
It happens. That's for
yeah,
sure. But you know, the interesting thing about Ruff to me is, you know, Ruff and Mayberry, you know, they're the same defensive positions. There's not
mm-hmm.
room for both those guys. No, one is.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Yeah,
and Mayberry did have a couple of ribbies over the weekend, but he's hitting only 189. So, you know, maybe it's time to send him packing and give Ruff the job.
Yeah, well, and you know, he had a key hit last night that drove in a couple runs, and
yes,
you know, but I just, he's had plenty of opportunities, and it seems like all the bench pieces that we've complained about since the start of the season, they're slowly moving them out one by one.
I was watching Comcast Sportsnet today, and Jim Salisbury threw something out there that I thought was interesting. Our favorite center fielder, Ben Revere, he noted that Revere has an option left, and with the way he's been struggling lately, Salisbury was wondering if they might consider sending Ben Revere down to AAA for a little while. Do you think they could conceivably do that?
Well, I'm sure they can, but I'm I guess if they're not going to play him, they might as well. I mean, you know, what are they going to send him down there for? So he can hit more doubles or get
well,
more walks? Or, I mean, to
maybe
me, they have
it. Maybe
far bigger problems than a 272 or whatever, about 268 hitter.
Well, I mean, if they're going to keep him at leadoff, he's got to try to get on base more with walks, and he's got to, I think, also work on his defense. He takes some questionable routes out there. He's never going to have a great arm, so that's not going to change. But, you know, maybe there are some things he can work on if he went down to AAA for, you know, a few weeks or whatever.
Well, speaking of leadoff, but how do you like the Jimmy Rollins move to the leadoff spot? And at least for now, he's responded. And, you know, we've watched that for years, and it hasn't been all that pretty. But for a week, it's looked pretty good.
It sure has. I mean, the guy can get on base, it seems, this year. He's, of course, got a little more power. Well, anybody has more power than Ben Revere. But the other thing is, I saw some stat last week that he's actually seeing more pitches. Maybe they put that on the graphic on Sunday's game. He's averaging, you know, seeing something like 4.2 pitches per at-bat as opposed to his, you know, 3.6 or whatever that he had seen in previous years. So he's being a little bit more patient. And, you know, by seeing more pitches, that allows the guys behind him to see more of what the pitcher is throwing. And, you know, it also gives himself more of an opportunity to get used to the pitcher and maybe get on base with a walk. So, yeah, I do like Rollins' approach this year. He's surprised me, frankly, because, you know, there's the expression, it's tough to teach an old dog new tricks. But maybe with Ryan Sandberg's advice or whatever, Rollins is a little bit more receptive to changing some things, and it's definitely worked over the last week.
Yes, it has. And, you know, I thought it was interesting last night where with Jimmy Rollins' two hits, and obviously this isn't a comparison, but it's something to sure be proud of. With his two hits last night gave him 2,215 for his career, one more than Jolton Joe DiMaggio. Who would have thought that?
Yeah, I could not believe that. I didn't realize DiMaggio didn't have more hits. I guess he lost a couple of years to the war, didn't he?
Three years,
okay.
Right in the middle of his career, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's 500 or 600 hits right there, so that's a big factor.
Absolutely. But, hey, when you look at the list, you know, and you're there ahead of Joe DiMaggio, it is what it is, right?
Yeah, that's not a bad thing. Yeah, and I asked Joe Ferry about it, Rollins' Hall of Fame chances. I mean, his numbers certainly could justify it. I think they're pretty comparable to Barry Larkin's, who's in the Hall of Fame now. So that's going to be interesting to see how Rollins finishes up his career and whether he will be a strong Hall of Fame candidate.
Yeah, and I don't see it. I don't see it. Good player. Real good player, going to have a real nice career. But I just don't see it.
Yeah, I don't
know.
I mean, if he gets a few hundred more hits, and he's always been considered a great defensive shortstop, so he'll definitely get consideration. Will he get the 75%? Who knows?
Yeah, I think he would have to somehow manage to come up with some, like, really strong season here at the end, because he's played since, what, 2007, his MVP season, and he's gone down slightly every year since 2007, 2008 time. So,
yeah, he has.
You know, that's a lot of tail end of career to be tailing.
Yeah. So he's got to maybe pick it up even a little bit more over the next 2 years.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. I mean, defensively, he's sure solid. And I think probably as a Phillies fan, and we've all gotten to see him every night, and we all got to complain about his not hustling and hitting too many pop-ups and all that. But it's because we see him every night. And the people that don't see him every night that are going to be a lot of the voters and just look at the numbers, the numbers may stand for it.
Yeah. And boy, you know, we talked about Richie Allen or Dick Allen earlier. I'm really surprised he never got more support from the Hall of Fame voters. With the numbers that he put up, the career he had, it's got to be just the perception of him as a bad guy or whatever, because, I mean, his numbers, I think, are certainly Hall of Fame worthy.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, when I saw the numbers, when I was looking up some information on him, and his very first year on the ballot, he only got 3.7% of the votes.
Wow.
And it was next to the last year that he got the 18.9, which was his highest. It was his 14th year. So he just didn't get the credit. But as you know, as we talked about his kids, boy, what a tremendous hitter.
Yeah, and like we were talking about with Joe, he was just so much fun to watch, and he was a guy who, when he came up, you sat and you just watched him swing that 42-ounce bat, because you knew there was a chance that he was going to do something special and hit one of those 480-foot home runs, you know?
Yes, absolutely. Well, that brings us up close to the top of the hour, Chet, so let's give out our thanks to Joe Furry for joining us in the Dick Allen Belongs in the Hall of Fame group. And as Joe mentioned, they do have a Facebook page, and you can like their stuff, and you can post on it and read what they're doing, and they're always talking stats and want to argue with anybody that doesn't think Dick Allen should be in Hall of Fame. So join up with those guys. It's a great campaign, and they're trying their best to try to make something happen for a guy that's a good guy. So we appreciate him taking the time to talk with us. It's been fun, and it's been interesting, along with bringing back a whole lot of childhood memories.
Yeah, that's for sure. And let's see if we can help drum up some more support for Dick Allen's Hall of Fame prospects. It has been a pleasure, Philly Press Box. This was really a lot of fun once again tonight.
All right. Well, now, as always, it's been great working with you.
Do it again next week.
Absolutely. We will be back next Wednesday night, May 28th. We'll talk about all things Philly sports. And we'd like to thank Mary Flanagan, our marketing extraordinaire behind the scenes, as well as our sponsor, shopforkisses.org. So for Jim Chet Chesko, this is Bill Furman, hoping you enjoy the show, and we'll join Philly Press Box Radio again next Wednesday night, May 28th at 7 p.m. to talk all things Philly sports.
You can listen through our Facebook page or Philly Press Box Radio or on the Internet at www.blogtalkradio.com/Philly Press Box Radio. High hopes, Philadelphia sports fans.